Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Julie Ellenbecker, president of Ellenbecker Investment Group. EIG believes in the importance of education, allowing people to gain the knowledge to feel confident in their personal decisions. This show highlights the unique financial perspectives of its many guests, including economists, attorneys, book authors, business owners, and tax professionals. It is provided for general information purposes only and does not consider your particular investment objectives or financial situation and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for you. Before acting on information on this show, strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial advisor. The opinions expressed on Money Sense do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Ellenbecker Investment Group employees and leaders. Please enjoy today's show.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellenbecker Investment Group, four-time recipient of the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for business ethics and integrity. Ellenbecker Investment Group is the only Wisconsin investment company to receive this prestigious award more than once by providing exceptional planning and extraordinary service each and every day. Go to ellenbecker.com and listen to Money Sense Saturdays at 2 and Sundays at noon.
Welcome to Money Sense. I'm Jamie Williams, Wealth Advisor with Ellenbecker Investment Group. Ellenbecker Investment Group is located in Pewaukee, just north of I-94 between Highway 164 and Highway F. We're in the Ridgeview Corporate Park, and we're also located in the Village of Whitefish Bay in the Equitable Bank Building across from Winkies, and we also serve clients in Bonita Springs, Florida. Visit ellenbecker.com for more details. Our guest today is Barry Mendelson. Barry is joining us as a friend, longtime friend of Ellenbecker. Barry is the president and CEO of Capital Market Consultants. Barry and his team focus on helping, you know, many people understand what's happening with portfolio management and kind of putting together proper portfolios that will help people in general achieve client goals. So with that, welcome back to the show, Barry.
Thanks a lot, Jamie. Much appreciated.
So yeah, great to have you back. You've been on the show a number of times with us over the years. Most recently, I think you were with Karen in the spring with the last show. So today, I thought it would be great for us to catch up a bit on where we stand in terms of the beginning here of the fourth quarter of 2025. It's been an interesting year, wouldn't you say?
Interesting, I think, would be an understatement. It's been a week after week after week of what seems like incessant change. And it reminds me very much, as I said to your colleagues just the other day, having worked at large firms in my past professional experience, sometimes in a large firm, maybe even with many offices, you go through a software conversion or you go through an upgrade. Mm-hmm. And when you go through that, a change in software, you have to take old information and old data and move it to this new system. And sometimes that conversion process is not necessarily so easy. There are quirks. There are pieces of data that don't fit. The new software requires 2 digits and the old software required 4 digits. So that all has to be changed. So it's a process that takes a series of weeks or really months until all of that is ironed out and everybody's familiar with the new software. And I think to a certain extent, that's what we're experiencing with the U.S. economy. The new administration has a lot of different policies from the previous administration, whether that's fiscal or monetary. There's a lot of change. And not all of that change is actually hit the economy yet or hit the marketplace. Some things are just starting to come in. Some things won't be emerge till next year. So the economy is going through some fits and starts trying to figure out sort of what it all means. And I will say, we have our own economist, Dr. Abdur Chowdhury, who used to be the head of the economics department at Marquette. But we read just like you do professional a market and economic observers all the time. And I don't know, I've been in the market 40 years. I'm not sure that I can remember a time when so many people had so little certainty about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody's hedging their bets when they talk about the economy and the markets.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned software upgrades or system conversions. I've been in finance my entire career going back to the early 90s, and it's, you know, like DOS, right, to Windows. And then something completely different now, you know, with the advent of the internet. I want to talk a little bit about the economy, the macro economy, just kind of some of the fundamental things, but also just wanted to kind of get your take on, you know, where things are in terms of, you know, things like where, like the 1990s, right? There's been some assimilations to what was happening with the .com and, you know, AI with the whole technology boom. Maybe you can just touch base a little bit on where you see things with the economy today, and then maybe reflect on some things that take us back.
I'll do that. Happy to do that. Again, hearkening back to what I just said earlier, if you read the news and, you know, government shut down recently, Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers were called into question. The whole process of how the government puts these data points together have been called into question. But despite all of the friction that appears to be going on and the consternation, GDP growth finished at 3.8%, which is really, it's really robust. Real GDP was 3.8% in the second quarter of the year. And the Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank has a weekly tally of their estimate of what GDP or economic growth in the United States is. I look at it every week. A lot of people look at it every week. It's not an official pronouncement of the of GDP for the Federal Reserve, but it's their estimate of how it's working week to week, and it's still at 3.8% as recently as this week. So we know that the economy is continuing to sort of grind higher, but it is grinding higher with a little more inflation than everyone would like. Inflation is give or take close to 3%, whether you're looking at core inflation or whether you're looking at the what's called headline inflation, in other words, the print that you see in the on the news, inflation CPI, you know, 3% or 2.9 or whatever the number is, but it's around 3%. There's a fair amount of speculation, informed speculation, about what's going to happen to inflation in the next short while and how that's going to reflect itself on prices for consumer goods stores like Walmart and Target and so forth, and the general consensus so far is that there has been inflationary pressure on that is a result of the new tariff policy of this administration, but not much of the increase in price has flowed down to the consumer yet. The companies that were exporting, the foreign companies that were exporting their goods to the United States, basically have cut their essentially they've eaten part of the tariff. The companies that are importing the goods have been absorbing more than 50% of the tariff price increase, and consumers have been eating about 20%. But the thought is, whether it turns out to be the case or not, the thought is a lot of these big companies that were a lot of the very large household brand name stores were buying lots of goods in the first part of the year to get ahead of the implementation of tariffs. And now that they're working off of that inventory and their shelves are in a place where they need to restock, they're going to be restocking at higher prices with the tariffs in place. And the thought is that they will pass more and more of that cost increase on to consumers. And consumers will start to see that, if not during the holiday season, probably shortly after the holiday season.
I see. Yeah. No, that is, that's interesting, because you mentioned that when we first began our conversation, just around how long it takes for some of these things to kind of work them the way through the economic cycle and so forth. So it is going to be an interesting fourth quarter here as we enter the new year. You know, I've been watching the S&P 500 and the other major indices that we pay attention to every day. And, you know, we've continuously been hitting all-time record highs this year, which we had a number of those last year as well. What do you feel is really kind of driving that mostly within the markets today?
Sure. Well, what's driving it is the performance of the very, very large technology companies. In fact, if you take a look at the AI-related companies in the S&P 500, they represent over 40% of the value of the S&P 500. This is somewhat of an exaggeration, but in some respects, the S&P 500 is like a technology sector fund with over 40% in AI-related companies. That's where the value is. That's what's driving the market. The rest of the market hasn't done much.
Yeah.
In other words, if you extract that portion of the market, most of it has been, it's been sort of very quiet. Earnings growth has been a lot lower. And in some senses, more a reflection of what's going on in the real economy, the everyday economy, you and I and our listeners here. But there's this very small subset of companies that are riding the wave, sort of a gigantic tsunami of interest in artificial intelligence and the impact it's going to have on our economy in the long run.
Yeah, that is really fascinating. I want to continue this discussion when we get back from our break. We've been meeting with Barry Mendelson with Capital Market Consultants. He is a market expert and somebody that can really weigh in on some insightful information with today's show. So again, we'll be back after this break. And well, thank you for listening to Money Sense. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams. We're meeting with Barry Mendelson. Before the break, we were talking about a number of things, you know, with the larger U.S. and macro economy. Before the break, we ended the last session with the discussion around AI and the profound effect that the technology sector is having on S&P 500 performance year to date. As I'm looking at this, Barry, we're in the first 2 weeks of the fourth quarter. The S&P 500 is up close to 14% year to date. There's a lot of other tech companies that are really outperforming that. But as you mentioned, it's driving so much. So there's 11 different sectors that that kind of comprise the greater S&P index and other indexes. Let's talk about that for a minute, because, you know, IT is leading the charge. And we've seen some changes within the last 3 months alone that have shifted some of these sectors from maybe an underperforming area to a higher performing. So one of those I would probably want to mention would be, you know, consumer discretionary, or, for example, maybe energy.
Yeah, energy. Energy had a good last 3 months. The sector up over 6%. We've talked about this. If you look at the best three performing sectors in the Standard & Poor's 500, of the sectors that you alluded to earlier, the top three performing sectors in the quarter was information technology, it was communication services, and it was consumer discretionary. Well, I think everyone can understand who's on the call today that information technology and communication services basically includes all of those big stocks, all those really big stocks, from Meta to Microsoft to Amazon, and so on and so forth, the Mag 7 and others. And the consumer discretionary sector also is an important part of the large cap growth index. So if you look at the best performing sectors in the last 3 months, it was the big sectors in the Russell 1000 growth index. So growth did the best, with technology up 13% last quarter, communication services up 12%, and discretionary up 9.5%. Mm-hmm. I would also point out this is sort of a derivative, so to speak, of the AI interest in AI. If you take a look at the fourth best performing sectors, who would have thought it would be sleepy utility stocks?
Yeah, what would be the main driver for that? Would you think?
Well, the driver for that is that all of these AI data centers consume enormous amounts of energy, and they have to get it off of the electrical grid. And it's sort of one of the potentially constraining issues that the technology industry and AI enthusiasts are going to have to confront in the quarters or years ahead. How is enough energy going to be generated in the United States to power these data centers and to power these chips? Utilities are a regulated industry. They're growing at 4 or 5%, yet the AI industry and technology is growing parabolically. They're growing at way into double digits, 30, 50% a year, at some point those lines are going to cross, because the utility industry may have started way ahead and may have plenty of capacity now, but if it's only growing slowly, why AI energy demands are skyrocketing, at some point there's going to be some friction. There's going to be some tension there. I'm not an analyst who follows Microsoft, but my understanding is they're either thinking about building or contracted to build a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, no, it's
because they need the energy. They need the energy.
And we're seeing how this
is going to all work out, I don't think anybody really knows. But you can be darn sure the utility industry is going to benefit.
Obviously, the data centers, you know, those types of things have become a very focal point, even just here locally in Wisconsin, in terms of like the development of these centers and so forth. But, you know, I guess taking that back to what I mentioned earlier around the 90s and the .com, you know, there are some similarities that people are trying to bring to this market back then. What would you think would be different about this market today versus the .com, you know, era of the late 90s?
Well, on the surface, I do think there are some similarities, and many, many astute market observers have drawn that comparison between the late 90s and the new millennium and what we're experiencing today by taking a look at the relatively high, you might even argue, extreme stock valuations of these Mag 7 stocks and the technology companies that support the Mag 7 stocks. But there are differences. There are important differences. And amongst the most important differences is that these businesses that are at the heart of the development of and the distribution of artificial intelligence, these are ongoing concerns that are making lots of money. These are serious and mature companies mm-hmm. that have been around for a long time. These are not Johnny Cone Lately's. And right. You might remember back in the .com era, it's sort of one of the historical jokes is how much money these .com companies were spending on Super Bowl advertising when they actually had no business. They had no business. They were hoping they would get a visit from the advertising spend that they did for the Super Bowl. But this is a very different story. These are mature companies that, for the most part, aren't one-trick ponies. These are diversified companies that have other businesses that will sustain them. But they've got so much capital and they generate so much cash. And they're, you know, in some respects, sort of relatively self-financing, although they're spending an enormous amount of money, just an unbelievable amount of money on chips and on these data centers. You know, one of the rubs will be, are they building too much too fast? Will the adoption of artificial intelligence and the use of artificial intelligence, will it be as universally adopted as these technology companies think it will? If Absolutely. it's not as universally adopted, or if chip prices come down and the profit margins aren't there, there are many things that could potentially go wrong with these AI-related companies. But right now, nobody's thinking about that. Everybody's thinking, I've got to jump on the bandwagon, so to speak. And that's in part what you're seeing in the stock market. These stocks are just kind of going up parabolically. And you sit here, scratch your head and say, is this ever going to end? Because clearly they can't grow. They can't grow from the sky.
Yeah, when does the music stop?
Yeah. Yeah, it may not stop, but it may level off. And it's that change in the trajectory which may spook investors. And I don't have any idea more than anyone else as to when that might happen in the future.
Right. To your point on you know, the comparison to the .com versus like this AI boom, you know, today I'm looking, there are over 10 or so companies that are valued at over $1 trillion. There's only one of those in that top 10 or list of 10, I should say, is a company that does not specialize in technology or information technology. And that is a financial company. That's Berkshire Hathaway. They are number 10 on the list. But they also have a huge stake in some of these companies as well. So
huge stake in Apple.
Yeah, monster stake. So very fascinating.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you, Barry. Before we take a break, I just want to mention that, we're meeting with Barry Mendelson, who is a market expert analyst who helps us and many other folks understand what's happening with not only the markets, but also, steering our strategies and making sure that we're picking the best, types of investments, or I should say the highest quality types of investments for our clients and their portfolios. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I've got some other things I want to put out there for you, Barry, to weigh in on. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Money Sense. This is Jamie Williams, Wealth Advisor with Ellen Becker Investment Group. I'm a certified financial planner here talking with our special guest, Barry Mendelson, who is the CEO. And I joke with Barry all the time because I call him Professor Mendelson because he's always educating us on the things that are important for us to be thinking about when it comes to putting together quality, kind of portfolios for our clients and giving people good ideas. So before the break, Barry, we were talking about a lot of things, $1 trillion valuations, most of which these companies are tech-based. Those all kind of predominantly fall into the area of large cap, U.S. domestic-based companies. We talked about the AI. Before we move on from that, Barry, do you have any other thoughts about what this what AI is going to do for us in terms of the future?
My response is I'm not a futurist by any stretch of the imagination. I think I could comfortably say that the use of AI is going to become embedded in the social fabric and the economic fabric of the United States. How long it will take, how extensively it will permeate our economy and the way we all do business and interact with one another, I don't really know the answer to that, but we're still relatively at the early stages where a lot of the gains, and this is a stock name that you'll know, NVIDIA. We're still at a point where the firms that make the chips that drive AI are the ones that have gotten most of the market attention, and other chip makers. But eventually, what will ultimately happen is that what are called the hyperscalers, they will take those chips, build the data centers, and build applications that people can use. And ultimately, a next derivative will be other companies that have like business software, as an example, or retailers, or other companies that are dealing directly with consumers or businesses. They'll be taking what those large-scale hyperscaler platforms can offer, and they'll be distributing them through their websites to their customers. We're still at a stage where everyone's very excited about the chips, and the data centers are being built. As we talked about earlier, the question really will be, are they buying too many of these chips? Will they use all these chips? Or are they not buying enough? And I remember reading a quote from Mark Zuckerberg, maybe 6 months ago, maybe 9 months ago, who said, in this frenzy of chip buying that everybody was going through when NVIDIA started really taking off initially, he said, we won't know until sometime in the future whether we've purchased too many chips.
Right. I mean, that's profound. It's supply and demand, right? How many do we need? We haven't even talked about disruption in terms of what could occur, in that entire space. If somebody comes along and does it differently, maybe with a lower requirement of energy or other things that might be involved. So,
And the chips are going to get faster, and the useful life of a chip is going to come down. And I think ultimately, kind of like computers, the cost of computing, the cost of telephone, mobile telephones. At first, mobile telephones were how much money?
Like 10,000.
And then the prices came down. Right. And then they came down. And I think that's what's ultimately going to happen. No one knows when that trajectory, when that curve is going to start turning. But when it does turn, and if the market perceives that turn, that flattening out a little bit is permanent, that's when you'll likely start seeing these stock prices pull back.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always go back to like the people that were buying the flat screen TVs. They're paying several thousand dollars, and now you can get one for a couple hundred bucks. PCRs,
right. This is another area where you're going to see that change over time.
Right. And so, you know, it will be interesting to watch this develop. Now, one thing I'm going to put out there too, because we're talking about high things at their price point right now. Price earnings ratios are at a point that there would be considered very high over the course of history, right? 25 plus PE on the S&P. Like you said, that is kind of acting like a tech ETF in a way. But, you know, I'm going to talk more about that for, you know, the investors and what they should be thinking about. But before we jump into that, I want to ask you about gold, because that is another thing that people has caught the attention of many in terms of the valuations on gold. What would you think would be, well, first of all, it's at all-time highs. We saw it hit 4,100 an ounce this week. And that's representative of, you know, stock-like index returns. So do you have any thoughts on people lining up to buy bullion?
Yeah, I remember sending you guys a picture of a line forming outside of a bullion store in Australia. And it sort of reminded me of people standing in line to get the next iPhone.
Yeah.
No, it's gold. I guess the answer to your question is, historically and typically, the biggest gold buyers have been central banks, but from a national point of view, India has been the biggest buyer of gold. And in some case, in some senses, after the 2008-2009 recession, most of the gold in the world was bought by folks in India, businesses in India. It's part of their culture, important part of their culture. But more recently, In let's say the last couple of years, you've seen this steady drumbeat. When you take a look at the foreign exchange holdings of central banks around the world, the largest holding historically has been the safety and security of the United States, of a United States Treasury bond or bill or note.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone always knew that every central bank stocked their shelves, so to speak, with investments they thought had very little or no chance of defaulting or going down in value in any meaningful way. But in the last couple of years, central banks around the world have decided they want to diversify. And I think the sort of shakeup in policy that we've seen with this new administration and the sort of, I don't know, disconnect or friction that has started to develop between the United States and other regions of the world, our allies, whether it's Canada or Europe or Japan or Australia or elsewhere, there's a different relationship forming. And so the longstanding view that everyone around the world should trust the United States dollar as being a ultimate source of value has been called into question. And people have been saying, we're not really sure that we want to believe in American exceptionalism anymore. And they're actually voting with their voting with their dollars. And they're taking the store of value they have. And especially central banks, they're buying gold like crazy. And now central banks around the world have more gold, value in gold in their vault, so to speak, than they do in United States treasuries. And sort of on the related to that, Jamie, something you wanted us to talk about was what's been going on in international markets around the world. And international markets around the world have done, anyone who has had an international investment,
yeah,
they should be well aware that they've done extremely well. There is a gauge, a performance gauge of stocks that are not United States stocks, and it's called the Morgan Stanley All Country World Index, but without the United States stocks. So it's essentially the rest of the world that's not the United States. So while the S&P 500 is a 14, as of sort of the end of September, a 14.8%, the MSCI All Country ex-US is up 26%. And it's not so much that they suddenly are better investments, but it's a combination of a few things, one of which is probably the most fundamental thing is, again, going back to what I was just talking about, the dollar has gone down this year. And this, idea of a U.S. exceptionalism and central foreign banks selling their treasuries and buying gold. That's pushed the value of the dollar down, number one. And that means that people who were investors around the world, particularly non-U.S. investors who were investing in U.S. assets like U.S. stocks, when the underlying currency under those U.S. stocks is deteriorating, they're thinking long and hard about, should I invest in my own country or locally in our region, or should I invest in U.S. assets where I sort of have some question as to whether we have, what kind of relationship we have with that country anymore. So the result of that plus the fact that U.S. stocks had these very high valuations in comparison to the valuations on international stocks made international stocks quite attractive. And so money has been pouring into international stocks basically all year. And it's why it has outperformed the S&P 500.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's important because, you know, we're going to talk when we get back from the break about, you know, some important factors that people should be thinking about with respect to their own strategy and their investments. But having an exposure to some international in your portfolio is critical to make sure that you have a well-rounded allocation. So with that, we're going to take a break. We've been meeting with Barry Mendelson from Capital Market Consultants, and you're listening to Money Sense. Welcome back to Money Sense. We've been having a great conversation with Barry Mendelson, our friend of EIG, CEO of Capital Market Consultants. Barry's a market expert, and before the break, we were talking about a lot of different things. We kind of finalized our discussion on the markets with regard to international, how, you know, that sector has been outperforming even the S&P this year. We talked about gold. We talked about AI. There's a lot we didn't talk about, Barry. I know that we'll save some for next time, but I did want to kind of just set the stage here for what investors should be thinking about right now with respect to their own portfolios. And then I want to kind of tie that back into, you know, some planning ideas and things that people should be thinking about for their own personal situation. So Barry, what are your thoughts on what people should be considering right now if they haven't been thinking about this for a while?
Well, one thing for sure is I think in the midst of all of this change going on in our economy and not knowing exactly where it's going to end up, I think, and with all of the headlines that the stock markets are generating and the narrowness of the stock market with technology stocks sort of leading the way and becoming a dominant player in the equity market, I would say to any investor who's looking to build a future, a secure future for retirement, that you should be talking with a planner, hopefully an Ellen Becker planner, to give you a steady perspective on what you need to do and how you should or should not participate in today's very exciting and enthusiastic market without taking on too much risk. Because at the end of the day, there's a quality of life goal that you're trying to achieve that's financially related ultimately. What you want to make sure is you maximize the odds of getting there in a way that suits your personality and your financial circumstances. Because this is not a horse race to see who has the fastest stock and the most fastest appreciating stock. This is all about the quality of your life in the future, and having a planful and purposeful way of doing that makes the most sense. It's the safest and most secure for people's long-term financial well-being. So having a planner by your side, I think, is critical.
No, and thank you. I mean, we would wholeheartedly agree with that. And I think most importantly, whether it's you're a do-it-yourself person or you're working with someone, we would encourage you to make sure that you're, you know, that they're reaching out hopefully to you, or you're making the initiative to get on, you know, get something scheduled. Because I think it's really important for people to really have a strategy. You know, you don't want to enter, you know, planning for retirement or, you know, planning for something really important regarding family or college or anything. You really need to be focused on those things. I think, Barry, you know, you mentioned it's probably easy to be distracted, right? It's probably easy to get in a position where you could be focused on one thing, but not all of the things that are important. So, you know, we haven't really had a lot of volatility this year. We had a 2.5-3% pullback in the S&P last week. We had a pretty significant pullback in April of this year, which I think caught a lot of people's attention. You know, now, you know, we've had 30 to 35 you know, days in the S&P that were records for this year. So I think that volatility factor, the VIX, has been relatively low. We're going to see that come back. So right now, I think, you know, people should be visiting their investment allocations. Barry, would you agree?
I would agree. When investors are enthusiastic about stocks, stock market volatility is low because everybody's just pouring money into stocks. It drives prices up and the market's basically unidirectional. It's just going up. Uh-huh. But when things happen in the real world, like the Liberation Day announcement, or the 100% tariff on Chinese goods. Now, they came and they went, but when you get to a point where some of those less encouraging data points come out, we talked about what might happen, the flattening of the curve with AI in the future, whatever that might happen to be, investors' attitudes are going to change and volatility in the market is going to go very much up. For more conservative, I don't want to say defensive, but for savvy investors, uh-huh, when volatility increases and prices go down, that's a time to be thinking about investing when stocks are on sale, so to speak. Warren Buffett, who is generally regarded as the greatest investor of the 20th century and maybe even now, he was really the founder of, him and Charlie Munger, the founders of Berkshire Hathaway. And that's a $1 trillion company. That's, mm-hmm, one of those $1 trillion companies. And they have about $400 billion in cash.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fascinating.
And he has been known as a very savvy investor, and he wants to buy when people are running from the stock market because they're just throwing stocks up against the wall and they don't care what price is, just get me out. That's when he wants to be buying. So he does the research on the company, has targets that he has in mind, and he waits for the market to give him an opportunity to buy. So I'm not saying he had 40% cash. I'm just saying measure the amount of risk you're willing to take, because there's, yes, plenty of risk in the market, despite the fact that there's investor enthusiasm right now. That can turn on a dime, as you saw on April 2nd and as you saw recently with 100% tariff.
Oh, without question. And, you know, it's interesting because people really, I think, can benefit from, as I mentioned earlier, having a strategy, but also working with somebody that can kind of put together some pro forma illustrations, or, you know, we use software. Our team, right, for every client, you know, we look at their investment allocation, whether they're new to EIG or they've been with us for nearly three decades. We're constantly just kind of understanding, like, what's the use case for some of these dollars in these portfolios, right? Whether it's their IRA or it's, you know, their taxable account, or maybe they're really kind of focused on saving in Roths, right? And the reason behind that is that for legacy purposes, that ties in with estate planning or just pure tax planning. So with that being the case, you know, we always tie it back to planning, and there's really a handful of things that are, we feel, that are most important, some of which we've touched on here today. The quality of your investments in your portfolio is key. You know, whether you're looking at, you know, different funds, mutual funds or exchange traded funds, individual stocks or bonds, you know, those should all be reviewed and make sure that you're doing some level of due diligence on that, or you're having a professional look at it. Diversification, you know, we talked about the tech sector being overweight now. Do we want really to have that you know, strict of a of a of an allocation toward tech, or do we need to pull back and rebalance, like we talked about? One thing that really doesn't really come up that often, but I think is most one of the most important things that people should be thinking about is transparency of the fees that they're paying. Most new clients to Ellenbecker, when we talk to them about what their fee structure is for their investments, they don't know. They're not looking at that. And the investments themselves, as a specific investment, might have costs that are unruly or maybe not justified in this current environment, because we've seen costs get driven down. You know, we now can run an all-stock portfolio for someone, and there's no trading costs on that, right? So there may be other fees, but as far as trading costs, that's been minimized. And I think I'll finalize this on two other areas that are really important, and that is tax planning. You know, we pride ourselves in working with our clients to understand their tax situation, and it's really important to have the tax professional engaged in that discussion. And, you know, we started a tax division here 7 years ago, and our CPAs are part of that annual discussion and or upfront plan. And then finally, the income protection, because even if we find ourselves back in one of the major inflection points in history, going back to 1999, 2000, 2008, 2022, most recently, we had another one in there, 2018, 2013, a couple really bad years for people. We don't want anyone to think for a minute that they have to go back to work if they just retired within the last, you know, year or two, right? So if we protect income through high quality fixed income instruments and have things set up properly, people should be able to sleep well at night. So as we're kind of wrapping things up, Barry, do you have any final thoughts or add-ons to what I just referenced?
No, I think you really you hit the nail on the head. I think having a cool hand look. Cool hand Luke right now is really important, with the market being so effervescent and in some senses people not wanting to feel like they're missing out. Absolutely. Keeping your hands in the game without being too overexposed to things which could hurt you and hurt the prospects for your future, I think it's really important. And having a planner, a sounding board, is really critical at this stage of the market.
Absolutely. Well, I couldn't have said it better. Thank you so much, Barry. We really appreciate your time today. As always, if anybody has any questions, please reach out to us here at Ellenbecker. We're happy. Talk to your advisor and make sure that you're engaged in the conversation. So Money Sense airs on Saturdays from 2 to 3 and on Sundays from 12 to 1. If you enjoyed today's show and want to learn more about our company, Ellenbecker Investment Group, and our upcoming events, please visit ellenbecker.com or give us a call. Our number is 262-691-3200. As always, we hope that we made a difference in your personal and financial well-being. And also, remember, before we plan, before we advise, before we invest, we always listen. Thank you so much. Have a great day.